We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This episode is Terror and Trauma. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Dr. Jeff Ambrose about the horror of Harry Potter and how it shows us approaches to embodied trauma. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions and cultural competence at Mount Carmel College and co-editor of Star Trek, Essays Exploring the Final Frontier, and Star Wars, Essays Exploring a Galaxy Far, Far Away. And yeah, several Harry Potter essays, too. Yeah. I'm still trying to work those into my introduction, Katie. I don't know if it's working. It's too long. It's too much. I should just say, I'm Emily Strand, professional nerd.
Well, but how exciting. They're both coming out.
They are both coming out,
and,
yes.
And we just talked about Star Wars and Harry Potter some in a previous episode.
Yep, we sure did.
Yeah,
yep.
All good.
It's on the brain. It's on the brain.
Today, Emily, we are looking at Harry Potter as part of the horror genre. So my question to you to start us off here is, like, what elements of the book seem most horrifying to you? I think there's some obvious go-tos like Dementors, but when you think about the things that really scared you in the book, or that, you know, gave you that feeling, like the horror gave you that feeling, what were they?
Well, and I know that feeling well, because like one of my first speculative fiction loves was Stephen King's novels. And I'm probably starting at like 11 or 12. I burned through like all of his biggest titles.
11 or 12.
I wasn't like, I don't think my mom totally knew what I was reading.
Same.
Youngest of five kids. Yeah, I kind of flew under the radar there. But I remember being in the back of my parents' car driving to dinner on a Friday night, and it was dark out. And I remember reading Pet Sematary because I was like at a place where I could not put it down, and being so freaked out, you know, like more freaked out than I ever thought I could be in a car riding down the highway with my parents. So like, what could get me, really? I mean, come on. So I know that feeling. And I'll have to say that the thing that really gave me that feeling in Harry Potter was the Inferi. And maybe that's just a stock answer, but because I know they're very scary to a lot of people, but there is something to me about the desecration of deceased bodies, right? And the manipulation, and that there's something really horrific to me, and that's manifested for me in other, something like the bodies exhibit. I don't know if you remember the bodies exhibit that came around to different museums.
Yeah, right.
I was like writing letters to people to try to get them to stop promoting that, because I mean, I was really worried about like, whose bodies are these? Where did they come from? There's some indication that they might've been like, you know, Chinese prisoners, and like that they did not assent, you know, consent to this.
Right.
And so I was like, so it's been long like I won't do zombies, like nothing with zombies. Yeah. No, thank you. Won't take any part in it. So, so that I have to say, that's it for me. Do you have a more subtle answer than me, Katie?
Yeah, no, like that scene in the cave with the Inferi in the lake is horrifying. It's really disturbing. And of course it's happening while this stuff is while, you know, Dumbledore's having to drink the, but it's so atmospheric, and then like the hand comes out. And so I So I was watching the Harry Potter movies while I was on the treadmill. This was a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And I would be, you know, watching, and the treadmill clocks your heart rate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm watching that, and the scene comes on, and, you know, the hand comes out of the water or whatever it is. And my heart rate jumped to like 200 and something. I was like, well done, Harry Potter filmmakers.
Who needs exercise?
Scared the crap out
right?
of me. Scared the crap out of me. But no, I totally understand, right? And it's that I don't like zombies either. I think they're gross, but yeah, also
it's
grotesque.
Too much. Yeah.
But I think they're literally interesting in terms of what they, you know, what they symbolize. But
sure.
I almost can't get into even like good literature, good zombie literature, because I can't get over the grotesquerie of
the
it.
Disgust of it. Yes.
Yeah.
And it, you know, I'm like perfectly aware that that disgust is related to a fear of death, you know, but, and I'll own it, but like also I fear death when it seems like that, you know, I don't fear
right.
death when it seems like a peaceful, you know,
yeah, that's hellish.
End
it's
to
hellish.
A long life, you know, yeah,
mm-hmm.
but that's hellish. And that really triggers me. It really
yeah.
frightens me.
Well, so speaking of hellish, I was also thinking about the Black Mass in book four.
Oh, yes.
Know, where, you know, Harry's literally, you know, tied to a grave and
uh-huh.
is having Voldemort stalk him and taunt him at
right.
night in the graveyard. And he's just seen Cedric Diggory die. And like, that was bad.
And then, yeah. And this really dark ritual is performed, and yeah,
right.
any kind of dark ritual, you're going to push my buttons. 'Cause I'm a liturgist. Right. So I'm like,
right.
I have a concern with ritual. Right. And so when you've
yeah.
invert it, right. Yeah. That is terrifying as well.
Yeah. But I also had one more that I thought was maybe a little different. And that was in book five, when Harry goes to trial in the Ministry of Magic. And I feel like there's this kind of bureaucratic horror where, mm-hmm. right. And he sits in the chair, and then he's bound to the chair, and his inability to speak for himself, and the idea that it's all just already the train is in motion for him to get kicked out of not only Hogwarts, but maybe the whole wizarding world. And, you know, he's not able to defend himself right before Dumbledore comes in. And there's something about that kind of bureaucratic horror. I don't know if that's even a thing.
No, it's totally a thing.
It
because
occurred to me.
I just watched, I'm in season two of Deep Space Nine right now, Star Trek, the Star Trek series. And there was just an episode where Chief O'Brien is hauled in to a Cardassian court for something he didn't do, but he can't prove that he didn't do it. You know, of course, eventually they do prove it, but it's that same, you're right. It's that bureaucratic horror, and it's almost too over the top. Like it's, and I would say this about Harry Potter too. The authors push it and make it almost over the top to really get you to have that horrific reaction of like the ambivalence of the system, you know, this
yeah.
total like arbitrary
right.
nature of justice in other people's hands sometimes, you know. And I think that is
yeah,
that's very astute
and,
of you to
and
be horrified
our power,
by that.
Our powerlessness in the face of that.
Mm.
And, you know, that's just very Kafka-esque. And Kafka
yes.
does really interesting modern horror. And so I think that's kind of what I was drawing on there.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. Well, I think some of these kinds of things are universal. I think the Dementors, everybody has a sense of how horrifying they were. I actually just saw the play, The Cursed Child, on Broadway, which was very entertaining. And the Dementors are genuinely scary as heck. Like, wow.
Wow.
We were glad we were sitting underneath the balcony, so there was no chance of any Dementors. Like,
no audience involvement for you.
No, that's right. Thank you. But I think some of these like horrifying moments might be kind of idiosyncratic depending on who the reader is. So I just thought I would put out a little shout out to our listeners. Please drop us a comment. Let us know what scenes or characters you find most terrifying in the Harry Potter stories. Kind of interested to hear what people have to say about that. Now, guiding us through our discussion of Harry Potter as horror today is Dr. Jeff Ambrose. Jeff recently attained his PhD in literature and has published on memory as a monster in Stephen King's It and teaching gender using Chuck Palahniuk's Fight Club. He has presented for nearly a decade at Chestnut Hill College's Harry Potter Academic Conference, and he received his bachelor's degree from Chestnut Hill. Well done. While working toward his PhD, Jeff took a class on podcasts, and for his midterm assignment, he tells us, he chose to write about a Potterversity episode. Well, it's so great to finally have you on the show, Jeff. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, and I've often enjoyed your Chestnut Hill presentations. You've been going for a lot longer than I have, but you have a way of, I think, getting into the things that hook like a lot of readers, you know, that really, I think some of the things that you do about like how we feel about the books and so on, I really have responded well to. So I'm really very interested in our conversation today. But before we get too far into the topic of horror and trauma, how did you first encounter the Harry Potter books, and when did you first start to think about them as a subject for analysis?
Sure. I actually have a pretty distinct memory of this. I was in sixth grade and I was reading a lot of like King Arthur stories and anything. And I was reading the first Harry Potter book on the back patio of my godparents' house. I remember starting the first book there. And then I just really got into them. And I wasn't critically into them until I was a senior in high school. I was in AP English, and my teacher, because we had to write critical papers, said, "Oh, have you read this Harold Bloom article? You've probably heard of it. His infamous Wall Street Journal.
Oh, yes.
Can 35 million book buyers be wrong? Yes." And I'm like, okay, I'm going to plant my flag here. Like, they are not derivative. They're not something that will never endure. Like, come on.
Awesome.
Amen.
Yeah.
Amen.
I know Amy used that a lot, you know, to attack Harold Bloom. And yeah. Emily, you used it as well.
Yep.
You used Harold Bloom. He's so quotable and so wrong. So very, very wrong.
Yeah, he's boldly wrong. He's boldly wrong. It's great.
That's the best kind of wrong, right?
Yeah.
Because it's fun to respond to then. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Jeff, I mean, you're confirming here the age of like 11 or 12. That's when we start reading the really good stuff that becomes what we, you know, what we want to read for life, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's cool. And even as a senior in high school, you were thinking about it. I love that. So one of your Harry Potter Academic Conference presentations that I saw and really enjoyed, you argued in that presentation that in the Harry Potter series, emotion is magic. What did you mean by that?
Well, sure. One of the first things, of course, that we learn about magic in the series is that emotions cause it before, like, I guess any of the children know that they're wizards, before they have a wand, before they really know what magic is. Their strong emotions can cause things to occur. The glass at the zoo bounced on the ground and onto the school roof to avoid the bullies.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then there's all kinds of key moments in the series. Lily's love, of course, giving Harry the ability to harm the Voldemort version of Quirrell in Sorcerer's Stone, Harry using Crucio on Bellatrix in Order of the Phoenix, but it only knocks her to the ground because he doesn't really mean it, as she and Voldemort talk about. The sequel to that scene to me is in Deathly Hallows, where Harry uses Crucio and it works really well, throws Amicus Caro into the bookshelf because he had spit on McGonagall. And
he means it. Yeah. He's got all the feelings behind that one.
And Ginny's particularly powerful spells that is highlighted very well in the movie for Order of the Phoenix, because she wants to kind of impress Harry and show up her brothers, who always kind of put her behind. But to me, over and over, we're shown that intention and the feelings of the witch or wizard matter even more than the words or the wand movements. And to me, those are just some of the literal examples that I've mentioned. There's a lot of figurative ones. Belief and confidence, of course, allow Harry to ward off 100 Dementors, to protect Sirius in Prison of Azkaban. Harry kills Voldemort ultimately by using a defensive spell because he's not vindictive. He's not angry, even though he has Voldemort's soul fragment in him. And one of my favorite passages in this series is the paragraph from Dumbledore to Harry about the love room in the Department of Mysteries. That love is, what does he say, more wonderful and more terrible than death, than human intelligence, than the forces of nature. And Amortentia, of course, the love potion, is what created Voldemort, not from love, but from its kind of fake simulated form. So kind of Voldemort then embodies hatred, right? While Harry is empathy and always leads with love as the counter to that.
Wow. What an amazing summary of that idea. Yeah, so much. And of course, like, you know, waving your wand and having stuff fly across the room is sadly not available to us muggles. but these emotions are. And emotions and intentions, that is a magic that we can tap into.
Right. Yeah. And I also think that it's helpful to see emotions as things that can spur us on to greater power in our actions, right? Rather than things that can inhibit our effectiveness, which I think all too often, you know, we do take the Vulcan approach of let's purge these from ourselves, or the Buddhist approach, if you will. And I think that the truth is a balance somewhere in the middle.
I was just going to say, you know, you hear all the time, like, don't let your emotions get in the way.
Right.
And instead, this is really about, yes, indeed. Yeah. And certainly they can for Harry as well. But there is the channeling of profound emotions is really important. And it is a power in itself.
Right. Healthy emotional display rather than, you know, some unhealthy version. Although, Jeff, I mean, to change the subject a little bit, I may take issue with your assessment of Ginny and her powerful spells, because I think by then Ginny's done trying to impress Harry. I think what we're seeing there is Harry's perspective, and Harry is being impressed, you know, not necessarily that Ginny is trying to impress him. I think Ginny is just like, hey, let's survive here. Like, I'm gonna bring out what I got, you know. but because she's always competed with her brothers, she is power, you know. Yeah. So I don't know. It's a fine distinction, but I thought I always gotta speak up for Ginny. Poor Ginny.
No, yeah, you're fine.
yeah. And I was thinking as you were talking too about apparition and splinching, which I think is such a good example of intention, as you say. Mm-hmm. And it's maybe a little bit more rationalist intention than the emotional, but like, it is like you have to know, you know, where you're going, and you have to be deliberate, and you have to have a clear sense of it. And if you don't, then you're between two places. And that's also really powerful metaphor. You know, as you get splinched, I feel like that all the time when I haven't had the proper focus on my destination. So I feel like that's also about the importance of belief, intention. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think Ron getting splinched, you know, Ron, he had not given himself totally over to the quest.
Right.
You know, and we, of course, that culminates in him leaving in Deathly Hallows. But when, you know, you got to have that intention, and your girlfriend dragging you to the next place, you know, is maybe not as, was not strong enough for him. For some reason, Harry could submit to it, you know, but Ron maybe couldn't, you know, and that caused it. I don't know. Or it could have been unlucky.
Well, we were just...
That's less fun.
There's nothing accidental in there.
I think so too. Well, Jeff, as Katie and I hinted at with our opening conversation, your dissertation, your shiny new PhD, in your dissertation, you focused on the horror genre, which of course made my ears perk up as a recovering Stephen King addict. How does Harry Potter fit into the horror genre? And how does that shape the way we read it and understand it as literature?
Yeah. So I spent a while trying to get into that in my dissertation, because, of course, I know a lot of people put the fantasy label on the series, even like booksellers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble listed as fantasy. Mm-hmm. And of course it is, right? There are creatures, there's magic. There's no denying it is a fantasy series. But to me, at its core, it's always been about horror. And this is a series Rowling has always said, of course, is written for younger audiences, but every book is like darker than even the darkest original versions of fairy tales to me. Yeah. Harry is almost killed in every one of the books. And of course, he does die in the last one. People are tortured all the time. There are dozens of murders of people, of animals. There's neglect and abuse, physical and emotional trauma, a basilisk roaming the pipes at the schools, the threats of the Dementors, as you had mentioned earlier, of sucking out your soul. You can be driven insane by the torture spell. And right, that's just a brief list. There are a lot of hallmarks to me, but the key one is dread. Because Voldemort is always just there, right? Lurking. He could be in your dreams, in Harry's thoughts, in memories, killing friends or family. And he's essentially immortal, as we find out with the Horcruxes, with his soul split and hidden. But to me, the other part of the question about how this shapes how we read the series as literature, I think the series has always stayed with me because of these dark moments. And of course, some of them are about how love and light triumph over them, but there are three scenes in particular that really unsettle me, and all of them are in Goblet of Fire. The series was already, of course, scary before then. It had mature themes, but Goblet was definitely the turning point for me when darkness and horror took over. And those three scenes are first early on at the Quidditch World Cup, where the Muggles are humiliated and tortured by the Death Eaters. But even before then, a much scarier scene takes place that I haven't really heard a lot of people talk about before. And it's the Vila, right? Like, the couple paragraphs right after that are nuts. Harry and Ron are with thousands of other men are about to like walk off the balconies and die to get closer to these like women creatures. Yeah,
it's played for a laugh, and she does that a lot with horrifying things, but it's bad. Yeah,
it's bad.
The second scene then from Goblet was the scene with Barty Crouch Jr. giving the Unforgivable Curses lesson, and where he is using the spider to show, of course, this is how you can manipulate people. And like as you said, like Rowling does, it first is for laughs, but then he quickly says, oh, should I have her jump out the window, drown herself? Like, this can very quickly turn into something that's not funny at all. And this is what happened to your parents, to your family.
And, you know, I and find that, the scene in the movie about it is, it was very hard to watch. You know, it's, it, it's like just watching it is really, it's awful.
And of course, the camera is looking at Neville when the spider is being tortured like his parents were. And then I know you briefly mentioned this earlier, but the graveyard scene, of course, Voldemort being returned to his full body form using blood magic, which we had never seen before. We don't really see again that much. And then when Voldemort in the film uses his foot to move Cedric's face back and forth, I never forget that. Like, that's so messed up and like so perfect
about
his inhumanity. He just doesn't care. Like, it's just this dead object to him.
Right. Yeah, that book is, I totally agree with you. And like the way that it starts even, like, like it's so, and my youngest son was really interested in Harry Potter before he could really even understand it. He wanted me to read it aloud to him. And I would be like, do you know what we just read? And we actually read the first three books that way. So he was maybe, I think he was maybe five. And we started the fourth book, and I'm not sure how far we got, but at a certain point, not too far in, he was like, I don't think this one's for me. Can we read something else now? Because it is horrifying, and she lays it on even right at the beginning of that, so that you know this is you know, this is going to be different. I mean, not that, you know, you're being chased after by a mass murderer who know, killed your parents and 50 other people. That's horrifying, but it's a little more abstract than we're actually seeing it in book four.
Yeah, it definitely becomes embodied. Although I did hear a, you know, I've listened to the, you know, MuggleNet Academia and then Reading, Writing, Rolling, and then this podcast. And I'm like, I know I heard it somewhere embedded in all that dialogue, but somebody was telling a story about reading it aloud to their children. And what they didn't realize is that their five-year-old was also listening. And it was the first book, and they got to the part, and I think they realized eventually, and they're like, oh, that's nice. The five-year-old likes it too. But they got to the part in the Forbidden Forest when Harry sees, you know, Quirrellmore, whatever we want to call it, drinking the unicorn's blood and then flying at Harry. And she said that the lovely reading session was interrupted by this just horrific scream from the five-year-old who then went tearing from the room.
Oh, wow.
It just was like crossed a line, you know? Yeah. So, I mean, I do think I do think you're right. Goblet, it does come to a head, but we have flashes of it before. And I'll tell you, my son, we tried to watch, once we finished the whole series, we tried to watch the film. So we got through one and two, and we got almost through three. And then poor Lupin gets under the moon and starts changing into a werewolf. And oh my gosh, my son just tore off across the house screaming. I mean, he will not watch that film. He was very doubtful. Now the way we watch the films is we go and see the symphony play along with them. And being in a big room full of people in a formal setting, that just kind of helps. But he still has got his hands in front of his eyes for a lot of the ends of the films. But So Jeff, what other, because the films obviously play into this, are there other moments either before or after Goblet in the films that you think are particularly noteworthy as instances of horror?
I know in your conversation earlier, you mentioned like the bureaucratic horror. And one of the things that, again, like, I don't know how people don't talk about this more. Draco like murders Harry essentially at the start of Half-Blood Prince, he kicks him in the face and then puts the invisibility cloak on him. Mm-hmm. Like, have a nice trip back to London. He's not going to make it. Like, he's going to drown in blood. He can't move. Like, if Tonks in the book or Luna in the film hadn't quickly found him, like, the series would be over.
That's another one. I can't watch it in the film. I can't watch it. It's just because it's the horror part of it.
And in the Half-Blood Prince book, of course, we have memories that didn't make it to the film with the Gaunts. Like Merope Gaunt, like everything with that is horrific.
Yeah.
The snakes nailed to the door, her abuse and trauma, like crazy.
So do you think that the filmmakers, I feel like I know the answer to this question, but the filmmakers do seem to have been very aware of the horror aspects so that they could build them in. And obviously my little story about the Inferi, like they knew that they were going to get you with the Inferi.
With the introduction of the Dementors and Azkaban in the film is really horrific.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think the filmmakers understood the horror genre aspect of the movie. Well,
I'm thinking of the Shrieking Shack scene. That's very much horror influence, like when the door swings shut and there's Sirius Black behind it, you know?
Yeah. And you're actually looking up at the angle of the camera is a little wrong as a way to make you feel small.
And as we've talked about a couple times, like Rowling plays with like comedy into horror, like with the second book and film, of course, we have all of the near deaths from the basilisk. Oh, through a mirror, through a reflection of water. You don't really see the basilisk. And then in Half-Blood Prince, we have all of the ways that Draco was trying to passively poison Dumbledore and how many other people that could have killed. Like, even in the film, we see with Katie, Hermione, Ron, and Harry are just leaving Hogsmeade. Hermione puts her arms around them. They're laughing, joking. And then Katie is freaking out on the ground, going up in the air, screaming, like, was nearly dead. These just come out of nowhere. And there's so many of those moments.
Yeah, where, that moment in the film, it's very powerful.
There's a moment where they're cleaning, what is it, the Burrow or the Grimmauld Place? And Molly finds, like, a boggart in the form of Ron dead.
Mm-hmm. Like, her whole family keeps shifting into her all her family members.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
Right. That's horror. That's being confronted with your worst fears. That's the Bogart. That's the whole point of the Bogart.
And of course, Ron was almost killed again when the love potion that he took and then the poisoned mead from Slughorn and Half-Blood Prince. Yeah.
Ron has a bad birthday.
There's a lot. Yeah. Well, Jeff, one of your key themes is that the memory of trauma manifests as literal monsters in a variety of works. Harry Potter is just one of many works that you're looking at. But where do we see that idea, memory of trauma becoming literal monsters in Harry Potter?
Sure. I think there are some quick answers, like Thestrals are only visible to people who have seen death. Ghosts like Near the Headless Nick retelling or reliving the Headless Hunt have his head almost cut off. Dementors, of course, representing trauma, depression, they feed on positive memories, leave you only with the trauma. So it's always a reminder of your own past, or the boggart, as we just mentioned, that becomes what you fear most. But to me, there are two big answers, and this is what I focused on in my writing, was Harry as Horcrux, and then Snape, who sees Harry as a kind of memory monster for what he represents for Lily and James in his past.
Ooh.
So, of course, Harry has the bizarre life because he's not really himself for most of it that we see. He's seen by many as a hero or the chosen one, the one person who survived the killing curse. Many talk about how his eyes are like Lily's, or that his like mischievous nature is like James. But Harry never knew his parents since they were killed when he was just an infant. And then there's that added layer of Harry's feelings being influenced by having part of Voldemort's soul inside him. In Half-Blood Prince, Harry speaks of a monster several times when he's has kind of that jealous rage looking at Dean with Ginny. There's one part where he even thinks about ripping him limb from limb. Or in Order of the Phoenix, Harry vents to Sirius about feeling angry. So Harry is just defined by the past, what he survived, what he represents for the magical community, how he's like his parents, but few ever care about who he is in the present. And with Voldemort's soul fragment inside him, he's never really himself until those last couple chapters of Deathly Hallows. And then the other side of that is Snape. Snape, of course, loved Lily and still obsesses over what he once shared with her. And seeing Harry every day with Lily's eyes, echoes of James' bullying, Snape does to Harry what James did to him, right? He plays a double agent, pretending to be loyal to Voldemort, but instead feeding information to the Order and protecting Harry. But how does that then make them monstrous, I guess? Well, for Harry, right, he must live without knowing whether his feelings and thoughts are his own, without his parents, who he's often compared to but never knew. Instead, he lives with part of their murderer inside of himself, poisoning his life, making him think and feel monstrous things, where like he wanted to essentially kill Dumbledore when he's ignoring him, in that scene where he had just embodied Nagini in the vision.
Mm-hmm.
And then with Snape, he's a monster to Harry and many students because his life is defined by the traumatic bullying and how that led him to then become that himself, to demean and ultimately lose his beloved Lily. So his life is a shadow one, defined by the past, never really living in the present, pulled between light and dark everywhere.
Wow. You know, I think that what you said there is so interesting and important. And as we think about it as a way to kind of understand trauma, that Harry is not able to be himself. What a really interesting idea. He's not able to be himself. And then, of course, his trauma does manifest, like as the other Horcruxes are used to bring, and even his own blood used to bring, yeah, Voldemort back to embodiment so that he can be this malevolent force out there in the wizarding world, and particularly toward Harry himself. Yeah. And then the one, you know, with Snape, that but it being very different, that it's shadowy and it's based on kind of self recrimination.
And with, like, especially in the movie, again, they sort of make it into like this abrupt thing, but when he's supposed to be giving the occlumency lessons and Harry finally like fights back and sees what his father did to Snape, Snape immediately, even with that one memory, says our lessons are at an end. Mm-hmm. Like, he doesn't even want to get into it. Like, talk about running or not facing your trauma. Like,
yeah. And then all the more poignant, his look at me at the end.
Yeah.
Right. Ugh. The real facing of it. And him knowing that Harry, as his the embodiment of Snape's failures, Harry is going to really look at him.
Well, and I'm really struck by this, you know, by how much this horror aspect of Harry Potter's sort of multifaceted genre, how much trauma plays a role in that, you know?
Yeah.
And how horror really traffics in trauma. And, mm-hmm, you know, for better or for worse. So, Jeff, could you talk about some of the central traumas in the wizarding world and how they influence the character? And maybe even like, what's the relationship between trauma and personal identity for the characters in Harry Potter?
Voldemort, of course, his first rise and reign of terror is the biggest trauma because it affected really the entire wizarding world. So even saying his name is like the taboo. It's unheard of. A lot of people say, you know who. So they avoid that for the same reason Harry or Snape ends the lessons with Harry. They don't want to relive their trauma because they don't want to relive that suffering or think it could happen again.
Yeah, and it's an entire traumatized population. Yeah.
Yeah. And we see that influence a lot of things, but one of the primary ones, the Death Eaters, the Quidditch World Cup, stoking fear and traumatic memories. But then, of course, the Great Suppression in Order of the Phoenix, Half-Blood Prince, saying Harry and Dumbledore made this up. They're idiots. Like, don't listen to them. Voldemort's not back. And everything with Fudge saying laws could be changed in the hearing that you mentioned. Like, it's crazy to the extent to which people go to not want to think about or face Voldemort again. For what that could mean. And perhaps for a more specific example, we have Neville. His life is defined by the trauma of losing his parents. They're, of course, still alive, and he visits them, but their minds are addled and cannot be healed. And that loss kind of fuels him to become someone worth remembering, not for the loss, but for what he could do in the present and future. That kind of becomes his driving force. Mm-hmm. So we have trauma work in that way.
How interesting. And, you know, that's also a little bit of a hidden part of Neville, and that's something we don't find out about Neville until later.
Yeah. That scene in Order of the Phoenix where Harry is visiting Mr. Weasley, but instead he sees Neville interacting with his parents. And even Neville's grandmother is telling him to just accept their like pseudo gift of the empty gum wrapper and move on. Both for Neville, who stays there and like takes it lovingly, and Harry, who observes that. Mm-hmm. I think that is like the key moment in the series for Harry, because he realizes like, this is what I'm fighting for. Like all of these people that weren't protected, didn't have a chance against Voldemort, have had their entire lives and families ruined. Like, we can change this. We can make it better or different. And it starts with facing that, saying Voldemort, going after him, not just waiting and hiding like everyone else does.
Yeah. And Neville is definitely attending to his parents in a way that's empathetic, and that it's very, he's there with them in a way that maybe his grandmother's is not so much.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we know she's kind of a callous lady. And I do sure. wonder, I would have to go back and read the passage to see if I'm reading this in or if it's there. I wonder what Harry thinks of that. I wonder if he thinks, you know, that that's worse than his situation, or I wonder if he thinks, you know, I wish I had even a shell of my parents to share a moment like that with.
Well, the shell is an interesting word, because I don't remember the exact wording, but like the description of Neville's mother is very much that, about like, she looks like dead while alive, like her clothes, her hair, like everything has changed, where like she's not even like human anymore. Like she's been robbed of what made her her.
Well, that reminds me, you talk quite a bit in your dissertation about this one critic who has, and maybe multiple, but one in particular you mentioned who talks about, who sort of says that trauma erodes the, you know, the personality of the character. And I think it's maybe a critique of when you have a traumatized character, it's just, they're just all trauma and they don't have personality. What's your response to that?
That was like the new tentpole thing for me. My dissertation chair sent me that article. I think it was just from like November or December of 2022 from the New Yorker, Parul Segal attacking trauma plots in literature. I'm like, no, like, there's no way.
Yeah.
So the critique of plot eroding one's identity, I will never see that as a weakness of the writer, because a lot of experts in trauma theory, like Judith Herman, who's probably the foremost expert, who worked as a therapist for a lot of people that suffered terrible traumas, know that trauma does often rob a person of their identity. Because the trauma overwhelms, it colors their every thought and action until they're able to find a way forward. And I've even seen the opposite criticism with Harry Potter. Like, how can Harry not have PTSD or other disorders following his early life with the Dursleys? Mm-hmm. And so my like clapback for that is look at Harry's life and choices. For his first decade, life with the Dursleys is all he's ever known. Like, he does not enjoy living under the stairs. How could anyone, or making breakfast, getting their mail? But what can he compare that to? Like, he doesn't have friends. He probably doesn't hear a lot about other home lives. He's a prisoner who doesn't really know how unique or barbaric his life really is. So when he finally gets a chance to have his new life at Hogwarts, Harry chooses Ron and rejects Draco immediately on those stairs because Draco is just another form of Dudley. And he gravitates then to love and building that family that's nothing like the Dursleys. He realizes that there is an alternate option. There isn't just this repression and hatred. So he quickly calls Hogwarts his real home. And people like Hagrid, Dumbledore, Molly Weasley, McGonagall, Sirius even become his surrogate parents. And so while it's easy to say Harry has been traumatized as a child, for him, what that was normal, because it was a life with little frame of reference outside of it to know how unusual or maybe traumatizing those circumstances were.
Right. Yeah, and then he moves to build a family around himself. Yeah. And I think J.K. Rowling has said something about how she felt like, because he had something stable in that first year of life, she felt like that was, you know, it sort of set a foundation. There's something maybe internal that recognizes that and tries to build it for himself once he gets to Hogwarts.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've always found that the least believable part of the whole right. series, that he would yeah. be so unscathed, seemingly unscathed. I know he's not totally, but seemingly unscathed. But then somebody was like, well, yeah, but it was that was also part of the effect of Lily's blood charm on him when she gave her life to try to save him and didn't have to, you know, and that blood charm worked to charm him, to protect him from the abuse that he experienced as a child from the Dursleys. I was like, oh, okay.
I'll take it.
Oh yeah, I'll take it. Magic. All right, magic. Yeah, good.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, and I do think, like, one of the things you're saying though is that Harry does have that trauma, and that he's not able to be fully himself while he's still got this piece of Voldemort in him. And yet, you know, we do see him as an agent. He's not just passive. He's actively doing things and working for good at the same time. And so there's a weird paradox about it. Like, the trauma is informing who you are, and it sometimes overtakes who you are, but yeah. it also doesn't inhibit you from, you know, building your life and having your personality and doing good things for the world.
Yeah. One of the quotes from that article is that trauma evacuates personality. And I mean, yeah, it can, but that doesn't mean like trauma becomes your personality, or like that's like your one talking point that, oh, I've been traumatized. Like, yeah, like, you can't make that not part of you. You just have to learn to, can you incorporate that? Do you want to cast that aside and put it in a box and try not to talk about? But that often becomes way worse for people. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of like the crux then to make my argument that for people that suffer from trauma, when they do push it down, sometimes they're forced to externalize it as a monster, put this on other people or place or thing so they can fight it as an external thing rather than an internal battle. If people have always like belittled them, or they don't feel comfortable talking about it, they have to do it themselves. So they put that outward, either seeing a person as their monster or a place, maybe the site of trauma or what's come to represent that. Something like that.
Yeah. And so would you consider that like a strategy? It almost seems like it's more of an unconscious thing that happens, but is that a strategy for dealing with trauma? And what can we learn about how to deal with trauma from the Harry Potter stories?
Yeah. So I definitely think there's a lot of good strategies that come from this series, both learning how to live, but also how not to live. That we have a lot of characters, of course, make mistakes. So I'm sure I could rant about this for a long time. Feel free to cut me off at any point. So I'll start with an obvious character, Harry, since he's our lens for most of this series. Dumbledore teaches Harry about learning the most powerful form of magic is love, and how we're defined by choices, not abilities. So Harry embodies those ideas fairly often. But for the sake of brevity, the clearest example to me is the formation of Dumbledore's army. He does not want to do it at first and thinks he doesn't have much to offer other people, but he shines, right? He finds confidence by giving others confidence. Luna, Ginny, Neville, Ron, Seamus. So many people grow because of Harry's support especially. But of course, at the same time, Harry's really flawed. And his desire to not burden others or potentially risk their safety, he often closes them off. And Dumbledore does that too, right? He does not share his thoughts or deepest feelings. So he's cold even to Ron or Hermione at times because of this stubbornness, or as Hermione says, how he could be so thick. And Harry eventually opens up to Sirius, but then he loses him. So the community of the DA becomes really important for him. So through Harry, we learn to not close off ourselves, and also the importance of finding a community of people, maybe not that have shared traumas, but that are there to support you as much as you are there to support them. And I would also point to Hagrid. Hagrid had a pretty horrific life. He was falsely accused of opening the Chamber of Secrets. He had his wand snapped. He then chooses to live and work at the site of his trauma. And then, of course, he's imprisoned at Azkaban. And one of the most horrifying lines of the entire series to me is he tells Harry that most days he wanted to die while in Azkaban. Like, that doesn't sound like the Hagrid that a lot of people know and love.
I know. Right? Hagrid is so strong. And for it to affect him, I mean, that's just a sign of how awful a place Azkaban is.
Yeah, Hagrid cares for like everyone and everything most of the time, even the ugliest, most unruly creatures. He can baby talk them. But Hagrid suffered traumas, but he never lets his life be defined by them. And I think that's an important lesson that we get there. But then there are characters like Dumbledore. We know almost nothing about his past for most of the series until Rita Skeeter's book. And he hides most of his life from those around him, and we might think suffers quietly. But I believe his traumas lead him to misfire with Harry in a few ways. While, of course, he gives him the great advice, some of which I've mentioned, he also hides from Harry. And throughout Order of the Phoenix, he goes out of his way to avoid Harry, worrying Voldemort could use Harry to get to him. So he could be selfish and arrogant, or he could be generous and humble. So I think from Dumbledore, readers can learn that closing yourself off is rarely the best choice. Maybe you don't want to like go to a therapist, but you just need someone else that you can kind of unburden this and not just have it be everything inside of you, where it does perhaps evacuate personality or overwhelm. Don't let it overwhelm by finding a way to open up to someone, whether, again, of course, we don't all have access to a therapist or a group or a friend. Maybe it's a family member or just someone that we find at a coffee shop and we want to overshare. Even something like that can really help, as crazy as it sounds.
Yeah. And I think Dumbledore also channels it into quite controlling behavior.
Yeah.
You know, in definitely. Terms of how he's master manipulator and so on. And that's kind of how he's trying to control everything. I think as a kind of penance for when he was going to go off, you know, for his year, indulge himself, you know, with his friend. And then the horrible thing happens to Ariana. And I think there's some sort of, you know, now I have to, I'm the puppet master, right? I've got to control everybody in my environment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, Jeff, what you're saying about, you know, talking it out, making it, putting it out there, making it manifest in some way. You see a lot of that going on in a sort of broadcast way on social media, or at least I do. And it's maybe not even the deepest, darkest stuff, although sometimes it is, but it seems like there is this instinct to do that, but you don't always, you know, with social media, you don't always get the most helpful response because it's just high volume. That's all it is. Yeah. It's not like in depth or, you know, truly empathetic. It's like, okay, somebody put a like on this. Great. You know?
Yeah.
But I think what you're saying is so important to think about having that person to talk to, you know, no matter who it is. Right.
Yeah, but I think that's a great point about social media. Like even if you're not speaking to someone, you're speaking outward, right? You're unburdening yourself. You're making a vlog or like a TikTok, an Instagram reel about something deep and personal. And maybe you're just doing it for yourself, but maybe that can help others because, wow, now I can do that too, right? So maybe some of the comments are trolls or stupid comments, but some of them will be people that, wow, thank you for this. I now have been able to do this. And that makes it worth it both for the creator and for the audience people that it does positively help.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I guess it's and it's just a mark of the longing for that too in our world. But no, yeah, you're right. I mean, I always say, artists take their pain and they make art of it, And I think that's a really important, mode of expression for that too. I mean, I think the present series, Harry Potter, is probably also an example of art being made from pain, and it's interesting the various ways that the tenuousness of life gets expressed in that. And one of them that I've always fa has always fascinated me is the is Hogwarts itself, and the fact that Hogwarts is kind of a cipher for the whole wizarding world. The wizarding world is not really a safe place. Like it's
No, yeah.
not, it's a wonderful place and it's full of magic and full of like awesome food and great people and friends for Harry, but it's not a safe place. And he even starts learning that from eating Bertie Bott's Every Flavor Beans and
I
Chocolate
was gonna
Frogs on the
say that.
train.
Yeah,
Right,
Bertie Bott's,
because
like,
the
that's
frog
not
can jump
fun.
away. No, I know, and you can get earwax, right? Or you could get vomit or whatever, and the your chocolate frog can just hop out the, I mean, it can just it life is tough.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about the Hogwarts teachers, and this idea of I'm thinking of like the announcement by Dumbledore of the third floor corridor is off
Yeah.
limits to anyone who does not wish to die a most painful death.
Absolutely.
Right.
What is this?
Welcome.
Right.
Yeah.
What is this pedagogy of terror at Hogwarts, and what are the paradoxes of the school as both a safe place, a magical place, and also a kind of a dangerous, terrifying, and traumatizing place?
I'd say with the notable exceptions of Snape and Umbridge, a lot of the teachers at Hogwarts are warm or at least competent and not abusive. But Hogwarts is a bewildering place, as you mentioned. It's a school, but it has a trickster poltergeist in Peeves, a hidden chamber believed to house a monster, a nearby forest
Right.
called the Forbidden Forest that you're not allowed to go in. A lot of the staff are enslaved elves, right? So another ghost is of a murdered student.
Oh,
In Harry's first year, as you mentioned, the whole school is warned to avoid that third floor corridor. Even the house system is strange, right? Slytherin is hated by the other three, ominously housed in the dungeons. The point system places a lot of pressure and adds competition to a lot of aspects of their daily lives. And even the library has a restricted section. And I'd also like to note that the series takes place in the 1990s when computers, let alone like pens, exist, but the students use feathered quills and parchment for essays. So I think it's really fascinating that Hogwarts is a place that kind of holds desperately to the past, but then also kind of sweeps it under the rug, says, oh, yeah, we have the Chamber of Secrets that might have a monster that can kill students, but we'll just go on like this is normal or okay.
Well, yeah, in the restricted section of the library, like those books are evil. And
Yeah.
they're like calling to you. Wow, it's sort of amazing to think about that.
Yeah. Of course, like there's the other side of Hogwarts. Students get to travel to Hogsmeade and get candy, visit a joke shop. There's Gobstones, Quidditch. We have the Dueling Club. So they could have fun while practicing magic. They have the career advice aspects of, I mean, a lot of schools have something like that, but they could take classes that they choose in their final years that could help them do something beyond school. And on top of all this is the fact that Hogwarts is a massive magical castle, right? With moving staircases, a lot of areas to explore or relax in. Even the Black Lake with the giant squid, the giant squid's friendly and likes being like tickled. We get the line about. So, I mean,
The paintings can be nice
yeah,
too. Right.
absolutely.
They're like TV.
So I think we have the light and dark there, which is, as you mentioned, like the it's a balance. Like as we've discussed previously, Rowling likes to kind of pair the comedy and horror together, because we're not all just the one thing, and that's kind of going back to the trauma plot criticism. Like, yeah, maybe we've been through something terrible, but that's not then we become Snape and bully others. Like, there isn't one way to respond or react to that. We see a lot of characters either evolve and change or learn to grow from their trauma, or
Yeah.
sometimes people are consumed or become obsessed over that one moment, like Snape. But even he, of course, still becomes an agent for good.
Yeah, and I like this idea that the horrifying experience is an opportunity for growth and learning, and that there's a way in which there's a maybe an understanding of that at Hogwarts, except for Umbridge, right? Who tries to take all that stuff out. Oh,
well, she wasn't supposed to be there.
Right.
She just installed.
Otherwise, there's a kind of acknowledgement, even like Defense Against the Dark Arts as a class is saying there's going to be bad stuff. And Lupin, who's like obviously the best of the teachers, he has them doing practical application of like facing their fears and everything in that famous lesson with the Boggart. So
yeah, in front of everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. And that idea that we're doing this and we're growing from our horrifying experience, like in community, also seems to be part of
it. I think there's the really bizarre thing with that, with the Mad-Eye Moody lesson, where of course it's not even Mad-Eye Moody, right? It's Barty Crouch Jr. teaching the students about unforgivable curses. And what he does is, by using Crucio on Harry, he teaches him what Crucio really is, like when and why, how to use it or not use it. I think that's kind of how he's then able in the graveyard scene to endure it, because he's realized, like, no, like, I'm not going to be what I've seen the evil uses of this. I know how to then stand up to it or not want to do that. Like Umbridge and a lot of their, even Barty Crouch Jr. as Mad-Eye Moody, they do kind of like bad things, but it leads to good growth or important lessons.
Well, of course, he puts all the students under the Imperius curse, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Like, but Harry's the one who's like, no, I don't really feel like doing that. And he's like, they'll have trouble controlling you. But then that, like having it in the classroom experience, it does make him able to be properly defiant when he needs to be, and not just, you know, go along and be obedient in the way that you might expect a child to be.
Right. It's all about the experience. And if you have experienced overcoming something, then you're so much more likely to, you know, that's why I always tell people musically, it's like you can practice and practice and practice. But once you've played the song in a concert setting or in a performance setting, you know, then you can always play it again because you've got that experience of having mastered it well enough, you know, to get away with it in front of a large group of people. So,
yeah. What's that famous quote, like, growth is on the other side of fear or something? Like, standing up to that, like facing it, absolutely gives you confidence. And I think that's what the DA becomes so important for so many of the students. Like, they don't have that. And of course, when Umbridge takes everything else away, that becomes the only thing they have.
Yeah.
So bonding together and growing, supporting each other becomes like even more vital than it would have been in the first place.
Right. And they're effective at what they're learning because they know the application of it. They know they're up against the wall, you know, with it. And that makes it all the more powerful.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, you remind us that the horror genre itself can also create terror and even traumatize the audiences. Right. So like we were talking about, I was talking about my son who was like, I don't want to read this book four anymore. You know, and the idea that, you know, we can like internalize some of that trauma just by being exposed to the story. Are Harry Potter readers traumatized by these stories? And why would anybody want to expose themselves to that?
Okay, yeah. But to me, like, that is the reason Harry Potter is so popular and has endured, because it shows darkness, but how to overcome that and what, like, the steps are to do that. So I think works of horror can absolutely traumatize in a myriad of ways. And a lot of those could be unintentional. If a triggering moment, line of dialogue, it relates to a viewer or reader's personal traumas, that could, of course, be terrifying. But in many works of horror, there's kind of the annoying twist. I love horror, but so many of them have bad endings. And for a lot of them, like Michael Myers or Jason, Freddy, they're not dead. There's going to be 20 sequels. And that can become exhausting and depressing, but that's not what happens with Harry Potter, of course. Mm-hmm. The good guys win, love triumphs. Harry dies, but he can choose to come back because he wants to save other people. And more than anything, I believe each Potter novel offers hope, love, redemption, growth. And as we've talked about, there are a lot of bad things, but that's not all that there is. And when the evil wins, it's only temporarily, if at all. So I think a lot of, again, readers have enjoyed and keep returning to these books and films because they're not the light at the end of the tunnel. Rather, the series presents that whole process, encountering darkness, working through it, and finding ways to evolve and adapt, ultimately finding light and love as the parts of our lives to hold on to and keep in focus.
Wow. Yes, very profound. And I totally agree with you. I also think that's one of the reasons why adults enjoy the books as much as children. And frankly, and I think that so many children enjoy them too, it takes very seriously the fact that not everybody's had a rosy life and bad things happen. And you're like, how do you deal with that?
Yeah. So I think it is like a lot of the classic fairy tales in that way. Like Peter Pan is pretty horrifying, kidnapping children in the original text. Like you can cut off limbs or part of a foot to fit into the stump to get into their hideout, or Cinderella being able to like shave off a foot to fit into shoes. Like a lot of fairy tales have horrific things, but a lot of them are about, again, overcoming that. My favorite G.K. Chesterton quote has been like reworded a lot over the eras, is fairy tales are more than true, not because they tell us that dragons exist, but because they tell us that dragons can be defeated. And I think that's what's so interesting with Harry Potter, fairy tales, Narnia, of course. They do this thing where they show the bad stuff, but we realize that everyone is going to have that. Like we can't hide from it and avoid it. Like people not saying Voldemort's name. We have to find a way to face and overcome that. We can't just be in the shadows like Snape. We can't just not say the names like Fudge or Umbridge.
And I think also like these books, you know, they don't make them easy to defeat the dragons, you know, and the horrors and the traumas. Mm-hmm. And that also like it earns respect from the people who are reading it, the audiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Battle of Hogwarts, a lot of people die.
Yeah.
Several key characters die. Harry, of course, lets himself be killed to finally make Voldemort mortal again.
Well, Jeff, this is so great. And a lot of what we've talked about here is based on your dissertation. But what projects are coming up next for you?
The most immediate thing is I'm actually working to give like a distilled version of the Harry Potter parts of my dissertation on Harry Potter's birthday at a library.
Ooh,
I'm gonna give
fun.
An hour-long talk to adults at night. So that should be fun. And for my dissertation itself, my advisor and Dr. Sturgis have actually asked me to try and turn it into a book. So I'm looking at options for that.
You should.
Definitely.
Beyond that, I'm now applying to every college teaching job that sounds fun under the sun, because even in my first year writing classes, I love teaching visual media. And one of my favorite lessons is teaching the opening scene of Order of the Phoenix. There is so much cool stuff going on with cinematography and how it relates to theme in that scene. So I've been considering maybe even turning something like that into a conference presentation or perhaps a chapter. I know we've talked about this earlier, even before we were recording the podcast, I think was the Langston Hughes idea, oh my gosh, I keep saying Langston Hughes because he's the most famous Harlem Renaissance poet, but County Cullen, my favorite Harlem Renaissance poet, did a piece called Thoughts in a Zoo. And I really want to do something with that relation to Harry Potter.
Yeah, so great. And I think a lot of your presentations, or at least the ones that I've seen, you do a really nice job of close readings and like taking us through a scene and helping us to see it in a different way. So I'm excited to see more of that from you.
Cool. Thank I'm you just so impressed that you have so much energy for so many new projects right after finishing your dissertation. So keep that energy going, and we will just have you back to talk about
Absolutely.
It all.
Absolutely. Oh yeah. Very much
Thank
so.
You.
Well, thanks so much, Jeff, for being on the show today. It was just a delight to have you on.
Thanks again. This is wonderful.
Yeah. And hopefully we will, you know, meet again at a future Chestnut Hill conference or elsewhere in the Potterverse.
Yeah, I sure hope so.
Yeah. Well, today, listeners, I'm going to leave you with some Albus Dumbledore sagacity. And this is from The Half-Blood Prince. And that scene that we were talking about, the truly scary scene in the cave with the Lake of Inferi. When Harry realizes that there are dead bodies within the cave's lake, he quite naturally, I think, expresses some alarm. And Dumbledore responds, "There's nothing to be feared from a body, Harry, any more than there is anything to be feared from darkness. Lord Voldemort, who of course secretly fears both, disagrees. But once again, he reveals his own lack of wisdom. It is the unknown we fear when we look upon death and darkness. Nothing more. Wishing you all wisdom and light."
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsbernd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsbernd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.